we want to talk a little bit about building more on the foundation of international solidarity process. How can we coordinate our actions here in the North with people in developing nations in the South and other parts of the world? And Shane, what are some of your thoughts before you have to take off for other places on how we can build on this international solidarity process?
I think one thing that's going to have to happen is that a lot of first world activists or organizers, and it will probably start there among the people who are watching and looking and you know, such, are going to have to start to listen to what people in the third world have been saying for years, and that is that the luxury that we have here is afforded on their backs, and that our privilege by living in the first world dictates a certain, I think, onus or responsibility to fight our own privilege, I think. And I think that right now you have a lot of activists or organizers or people who think the WTO is bad or know it's bad, who are still in their organizing, aren't challenging that basis of their privilege. They can go to a protest and be usually fine and go home that night and watch it on the news. You know what I mean? The actual conflict between those people of the world, the people of the world, and that top 1%, that fight is going to become much more intense and probably much more bloody. And I think we're not going to enjoy it. And I think we all know that that's coming. And I mean, I don't think I'm a doomsday sayer in saying that eventually there is going to be some final conflict between peace and war. You know, and I think that in Seattle we saw a lot of that. You know, and I think what we're going to have to start to do in the first world, you know, is again catch up with a lot that's been going on in the third world, you know. And I think where people suffer severe, I mean like death, prosecution by their governments in the most severest and most disgusting ways, which is completely funded and supported by the first world, we're going to have to start to learn to take our lumps, I think, and roll up our sleeves, and the next time the WTO starts, maybe some more stronger direct action. I mean, I don't believe in violence against people, but I think that we have to be able to in working with the members of the third world, be able to say loud and clear, this is where we stop here. We will no longer. I mean, and it's not only a matter of not participating. You know, we can say, oh, you know, I won't take part all I like. I mean, I might as well hand the gun to someone else. I mean, not taking part is not abdicating your responsibility, and I find that very much with a lot of the tradition in the first world, which I think we're going to have to drop if we're going to work with the third world.
Do you think that people who are not willing to go the route of direct action could do other things in support of a third world by engaging in boycotts?
I don't think boycotts do much, personally.
Or strikes?
Strikes, yeah. I think that we're going to have to get to a place where the actual wheels of the machine stop turning. When I don't buy my coffee from a certain place, or I don't buy my McDonald's, I mean, I think that's good. I mean, I think if that were to be on a mass scale, then I think that would alleviate much suffering. But I've heard a lot of arguments against boycotts when they're not orchestrated and coordinated with people in the third world. A lot of first world
workers
who are going to lose their jobs when these little pink toys suddenly no one's buying them anymore. You know what I mean? Or whatever, you know.
Right.
So again, a boycott is going to be just a fanciful whim of first world thoughts unless it's coordinated.
So what we're talking about is a way to coordinate from the first world consumers working in solidarity with the third world workers. Take for instance Nike shoes.
The thing that kind of I don't really like about boycotts is it subjugates individuals to consumers. You know, it says that your power is in what you buy. And you do have power in what you buy, but you have far more power, I think, in other places of your life than simply what you buy. I mean, I think that's good. I mean, that's just a matter of course. Everyone should be doing that. But the boycott kind of craze of the early 90s and the late 80s, I mean, I think it kind of drove home to people more and more that you are a consumer and a consumer only, you know. And I think that's what the World Trade Organization is telling us, is that you aren't citizens, you are consumers. And how can we
exercise our powers beyond the consumeristic approach?
Well, most people work.
Besides the strikes.
Most people work. And I think that there's so much goes into coordinating. I mean, people have to stop thinking that protest is simply what you see on the news, and it's a big rally with people holding signs. The real work to what happened in Seattle took place months and months before. It was working in solidarity, and that takes work. There's a logistical work. People need places to stay. We need food. We need people to donate money. We need time. We need people's time, and like more than just the half an hour on Sunday. Like, I don't want the going to church syndrome. I've done my bit for the week, so I don't need to do any more kind of crap. Like a 1 week, 1 month. I mean, maybe you only have an hour, and that's really all you've got. Then that's great. But if it's just sort of white guilt appeasement crap, I would rather you stay at home. But we need people's time, and I think that there are. I mean, there are lots of people. I mean, the TO wasn't just 10 people. I mean, that was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of actual organizers, let alone the people who came out, you know. And that's what we need to see more. People volunteering their time and their labor, some of their money and their hearts into what's happening, and not just going to the grocery store and not buying a papaya. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
Yes, I agree with what Shane is saying, that it needs a lot of not only time, but financial organizing and solidarity. It's as Shane said, it's not enough not to buy papayas, because there is so much at stake here. We are not only fighting about, you know, the life that we have now. We are fighting for the life of the young generations. What will we say to our great-grandchildren when the earth will become bald, or when the earth has nothing to offer to our young generations? So we really need to make a solidarity, not only here in the north, but also extend hand to the south. The south had so much grassroots experience in terms of like what happened in Seattle. And I would like to make a comment that Seattle had really opened the world eyes, and I really am so kind of thankful and appreciative of those who have spent hundreds of hours of their time organizing to make this Seattle happen. I have seen how the effects of the young people here in the British Columbia had organized. All the different organizations, not only youth, but the senior citizens were also involved. And having been come here and learned this, and having witnessed firsthand on the news what had happened in Seattle, had really given a hope, not only to the southern people, but to the world as a whole. As I was saying a while ago, no one will be spared with the effect of this WTO. Everybody is going to be affected. Because, as I said again, they are now going into controlling the food that we eat. It's already here in North America, not only in the southern countries, but all over the world. They are controlling the water that we drink and the air that we breathe. Who pollutes the air that we are breathing now? Who rape our natural resources, the forest, through logging companies? So we need to find a way in which all those who are opposing the WTO will join hands together. It needs effort, time, money and other resources. And all the skills, the media, we really like to kind of say we need the support from the media, because it is the one that, you know, that is a very powerful tool for awareness raising. And thanks, Shaina, for providing this venue today to express our thoughts from the grassroots level.
Thank you.
You brought up a good point in regards to mainstream media. Maybe some of the panelists have some thoughts on how we can nudge, push, point out to the mainstream media that they are severely lacking in their reporting regarding the rulings and actions of the World Trade Organization, not to mention other transnational corporate decisions and that sort of thing. And what, you know, do people, Sol, maybe you have an idea of how we can, you know, get the mainstream to be a little more responsible for covering these issues?
I actually don't really think we could, because I think the mainstream media is exactly what we're fighting. It's a big corporation, and they're never going to listen to us. They're never going to tell the real story, because then they're going to lose their jobs or they're going to lose their profits. And I think one role that the mainstream media has played in, which I kind of think is somewhat positive, in what happened in Seattle, for example, is that, you know, like the mainstream media really likes to just play up all the violence, and that's all they talked about. They didn't talk about the real issues of the WTO, and I never expected them to. But I think the fact that they showed all of this, you know, everyone, when they hear the word Seattle, they're going to turn their heads. So the real work has to be done at this level, at the grassroots media. It has to happen at, you know, us talking to our neighbors, you know, sitting on the bus and say Seattle louder than usual and start talking about the WTO, because everyone's going to turn around and look, you know, when you say that. And that's because of the mainstream media, that, you know, everyone, you know, if I, you know, say that I was down in Seattle, you know, they know I was down in Seattle for, you know, for fighting against the WTO. I wasn't just down there for a holiday. And, you know, and that's because of the mainstream media. But the mainstream media is never going to talk about the real issues, and the real work has to happen at the, you know, through guerrilla media and through, you know, through CFUV and all the campus radios and all of the, you know, all the other ways of getting out our information and on the internet. And yeah, so that's, I think, where the real work has to come from. But this has kind of given us a window of opportunity, you know, because the word is out there, because you can say Seattle, because you can say the WTO, and people are going to stop and listen, not necessarily because they are against WTO or even know what it stands for, but because, you know, they're intrigued by what happened there. They're intrigued by this battle in Seattle.
The sensationalistic approach
that, you know, we can use to our benefit. On its own, it sucks. There's nothing. I mean, there's nothing of substance there, and people are probably going to see that and think, well, I'm never going to go and protest because this is what's going to happen to me. But it gives us that window of opportunity to start talking about what it is really about, and about the empowerment that came out of Seattle, about the positive stuff that came out of Seattle, that it wasn't just you know, police repression. It was about solidarity, and it was about, you know, this real sense of freedom that we got in resisting corporate domination. And so, yeah.
All right. Charlie, would you like to say something?
I think one of the lessons that we learned in opposing the war in Vietnam was how to utilize the media as a tool to get our points of view across. Like, I remember being interviewed on the NBC National News when the reporter asked the question, what would you like? Would you like to come home? And you're fronted with a question that you don't control. Me, I spent 3 or 4 minutes discussing the unjust nature of the war. And you're faced only with an emotional question that's in the interest of the TV show to broadcast. And so out of a 3 or 4 minute interview, only 13 seconds went on the air. And it was controlled by a voiceover of the announcer that was in his interest. So you have to be able to learn how to control your response to any question that would fit in with the agenda of the masses. So after that, we learned that any question being brought forward by a media spokesperson of the multinational corporations to make it be re-articulated within the interests of the population. So fighting on the media for your point of view became an important component of the struggle. How do we get the struggle of the multitudes voiced on media, which are actually, when you get down to it, financed by the profits that we create for the multinationals and for the media systems that exist? Like, how do we reconcile the fact that we are the creators of the roads and the cars and the electrical systems that exist, but we don't gain any of the profits from them? We create them, but we don't result in the benefits. Like my mom working at 6th Avenue in the alterations department, got $55 a week when she worked on dresses that cost $15,000. So that her wages were less than a third of the yearly salary that would equal the amount of the dress being sold to Mrs. Dodge. Now, how does it relate to a third world worker in 1960? Maybe she made $55 a week, whereas the worker in the Philippines may have made $5 a week or $2 a week. So, there are levels of exploitation of working people that are reflected throughout the capitalist world and the imperialist-controlled world. And it's by unifying their common struggles that we then can result in a victorious struggle. Thanks.
Thank you, Charlie. So part of that, what I heard out of that was that possibly if we were, you know, finding ways and means to dump the WTO and create a more humane international trade organization, let's call it the World Labor Organization, for example, that one of the things that would be on the top of the list would be equitable working wages and conditions. something that, like Charlie pointed out, that back in the 60s, a woman garment worker in the U.S. could be making only $55 a week, yet someone in the Philippines doing the same job would be making only $2 a week. Now, there is, you know, looking back 40 years, that's some significant discrepancies. I'm sure it's even worse nowadays, which is unfortunate enough to say. But do you think from Petra or Cezanne's perspective that this would be one of the a crucial point of top priority in terms of you know, creating a more humane labor / environmental organization that could replace the WTO?
Yes, because in the Philippines, really, there are lots of cheap labor for companies. That's why they are pushing this WTO, so the multinationals or the capitalists could invest their money in the third world countries where there are cheap labor, cheap materials, and tax exempt or lower tax on in terms of benefits that are being given by the government. And the I think the first world nation will lose their job because the companies in the first world countries would like to reinvest their money into the third world countries.
Petra?
Yeah, I would like to kind of raise that point too on the effect of the consumers here and the production in the southern countries. It is very true what Charles said a while ago, that there is such a discrepancy in terms of the monetary gain being given by the workers. For example, he talked about that the $2 that is the cost production of what is being spent in the, for example, let's take for example the Philippines, like for example in clothing factories or shoe factories. The product production cost maybe the company about less than $5. And I noticed that when it's being sold here in Canada, we buy at about $100 or more per item. So let us kind of see where the discrepancy kind of occurs. Not only our people are being exploited in the Philippines, but the consumers here in Canada are also doubly exploited because granting that the $5 is a production for one shoes, and they give maybe $2 as a labor to produce one shoes, it comes here in Canada and being sold at $100. So look at the insidious profits that this corporation are getting from all of us, southern and northern consumers. So I would like this to kind of a challenge for the consumers here in Canada or in the northern countries, northern countries, because I feel that having been lived here in Canada, that the people, most people thinks here because of lack of awareness or education on what's really happening, that they think that they are not affected. But they are, we are here in Canada, is very much affected by this WTO.
Saul, would you like to comment on that? Do you feel that this would be being able to create more awareness of the fact of the first, for lack of better terms at this point, that to educate people here in the North of the exploitation of the first world consumers on the backs of the exploitation of the workers in the third world, that we need to possibly create some kind of an educational campaign on these specific transnational corporations and to, you know, somehow bring to light these kind of exploiting everybody at their cost? Do you think an education plan would be effective?
Yeah, I mean, I think we definitely need to educate people. I think a lot of people know already, though. You know, like anyone I talk to, you know, who activists or not, they know that, you know, people in the third world are working in sweatshops and at like a dollar a week or whatever. And I mean, I was taught that in high school and junior high. And I think what we need to teach people is how to organize and how to, you know, take action against that. Because, you know, I think people do know. People know what's going on. They may ignore it, but people know that people are, you know, losing their jobs here so that jobs can be, you know, so that they can exploit people in other countries for, you know, a lot less wages. And, you know, and people know about these things, but what we need to know how to do is organize together and work together and, you know, work to organize an international labor strike, general strike on an international level. What could be more powerful than that? And, you know, along with a boycott all at the same time, you know, say, you know, combine the two, boycotts and labor strikes and general strikes and on an international level. And let's, you know, put it a couple years in the future and let's aim for that and let's do it. You know, we gotta take massive actions. And I think that's what, that's from my understanding of just, you know, what resistance around the world is that, you know, it can't just take place in one country. Like, it can't just take place in Indonesia. It can't just take place in the Philippines. We got to all work together because it's our country that's going to then go in and, you know, and kill people who are resisting or wage a long war on the people for resisting and standing up for the rights. But we need to do it at home, and we need to do it, you know, all around the world. So let's organize how to organize education campaign
from a unified front.
From
you know, from all perspectives, because we're all learning.
Mm-hmm. Or I think it's not so much an education campaign of like propaganda. It's like, let's educate each other at the community level. Let's you know, talk to your neighbors and let's organize with our neighbors to their job. And you know, what's kind of interesting too is how all these corporations are merging together and all these small businesses and stuff going out of business. Well, one corporation, there's a lot of people all around the world working for that same corporation. So if everyone is to go on strike at the same time, that's a lot of people. That's just a thought.
Okay, we're wrapping up our special 3.5 hour program of A Show of Solidarity today. I want to thank everyone for being here. The initial panelists, Saul Arbes, Joan Russo, Terry Wolfwood, Sol, and Charlie Steimek. And then thanks again for also Shane Calder to come in and Petra and Suzanne. It's been great. Do you have something to say briefly, Charlie?
Just a short thing. There was a general strike in Canada on at least two occasions, one of which I participated in, which is called by the Canadian Labour Congress against Trudeau's anti-inflation board program, probably in about 80 or 81. And there was this general strike in Winnipeg in 1919. Mm-hmm. And we do have a history, a struggle within our country. And a lot of it was actually the anti-inflation board strike. There were at least 100,000 people in Ottawa during it, in the whole country. All the labor movement shut down. So from transit workers to clothing workers to auto workers and steel workers. It's not an intellectual exercise, but a real thing.
Thank you. And any closing comments, Suzanne?
I would like to appeal for the Canadian government and the people of Canada to stop sending like military aid to the Philippines, because it's really they are using to kill our people, especially those resisting what they call destructive developments such as mining, logging, and others. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Petra.
Yeah, I would like to thank you, Jana, for providing this venue and all our listeners that are listening to our points of view and our concerns. I would like to say that I am an adopted Canadian, and what I know of Canada is being a number one of world peace. Let us really kind of work for world peace, what that Canada stands for all over the world. Let's not stain that notion, or let's not stain that message to the world that Canada is one of the country that are working for human rights. Let's really apply it in real sense. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody. And I want to also thank CFUV and all the people's media workers here in Victoria and around the world who are struggling and working towards positive, humane changes in our media and on the streets of where we live around the world. Thanks again to CFUV.